Hello, everybody. I've got an announcement about the California University Exchange first. If any of you are interested in doing an exchange with the University of California in your second year, there'll be a meeting about that on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, at 4 o'clock in room H545. And there'll be somebody from the international office as well as somebody from the English department, and we hope some, at least one person who's done the exchange previously. That's the University of California Exchange, H545, 4 o'clock this Wednesday. Have you all got the handout? There's some copies coming around here. Dimitri, it might be quite good if there were some up by the door too for anybody who comes in late, because either everybody's got bad colds or nobody's interested in Morn. Thank you. Morn was a hugely prolific writer and a very commercial one. And some of the issues around that will be in the background of what I have to say, and I'm sure in your conversations, in your seminars. Among his works, plays, novels, short stories, there are at least two volumes of collected short stories. Could you shut that door, please? And in those volumes, there's a story called The Colonel's Lady. Like much of his work, it was adapted for TV. A lot of his other work was adapted for movies. Anyway, this one was made into a one-hour TV adaptation, part of a series of 39 episodes made by ITV in the early 1960s. The Colonel's Lady. Now, in this story, a conventional conservative country gentleman, a retired soldier, army officer, is in a kind of pragmatic marriage. There are no children. They aren't particularly in love, but they roughly get on with each other. He has a woman he sees in London. His wife, rather late on in the marriage, brings out a book of poems, and she gives it to him to have a look at. He takes it off to the room where he normally reads his magazines about hunting and shooting, and he noticed that the volume contained no more than 90 pages. That was all to the good. He shared Edgar Allan Poe's opinion that poems should be short. But as he turned the pages, he noticed that several of Evie's had long lines of irregular length and didn't rhyme. He didn't like that. Well, he doesn't read with any care, but he does tell his wife he thinks the book jolly good. And he thinks that's going to be the end of the matter. And then he's rather surprised when people come up to him at his club and in the street and say, very, very good book Evie wrote. I'd be glad if you'd tell her how good I thought it was. And he finds that, and she finds that the book turns into a big critical success and also a commercial success. And there are parties for it given by the publisher, and magazines want to interview her, and they get invited into a social world that he's never known before. And he also increasingly notices at these big occasions that people are looking at him and they seem to be talking about him. So he's not stupid, the Colonel. He's fairly stupid, but not totally stupid. And he thinks he'd better have another look at the book. And this time he reads it properly for the first time. And he finds that it recounts a story. It's a book of poems, but the poems tell a story. And the story is of a woman who has an affair with a younger man who dies. And he realizes that this is a true story that his wife has told through her poetry. And he's very offended, and he feels a terrific loss of pride and wants to know what to do about it. And so he goes to see an old friend who's a solicitor, a very intelligent, practical man who's also read the poems himself, and who responds to his anger with various sort of mild questions. One of which is, have you always been faithful to her? Have you always been faithful to her? And he says, well, more or less, you know. After all, we've been married nearly 24 years, and Evie was never much for bed. I won't deny that I've had a bit of fun now and then. A man wants it. Women are different. And the solicitor says, well, we've only a men's word for that, with a faint smile. I won't say how the story ends, but I'm simply using it as an illustration of several points I want to make, all of which apply to pretty well all of Malm's work. The first is that the story is very simply written and traditionally constructed. It of itself is by no manner of means an experimental work, on the contrary. And what it concentrates on doing is telling a human story which we are curious about. We want to know how it's going to end. Second, that apparently paradoxically, because it is very traditional, it is sympathetic to and interested in experimentalism in the arts. We don't learn much about Evie's poetry. It's not quoted. But we learn enough to know that it offends the kernel through its modernism. Third, the story is characteristic of Malm's work in that it is conscious of female sexuality and critical of the double standard practiced by men in relation to it. The double standard expressed by the colonel when he says, you know, well, of course I've been around a bit, but men are different. And it's also respectful to the idea of women as artists. None of these things will seem very radical to you now, but they were not very usual at the time that Malm started writing. Fourthly, and again typically of Malm, the story is absorbed in problems faced by ordinary people in ordinary situations. They're middle-class people in this case, but they're not, as it were, artists or intellectuals. The wife is, but not the husband or the solicitor. And lastly, the story is interested in and knowledgeable about how narrative storytelling can, from the writer's point of view, whether in prose or poetry or drama, act as an emotional outlet, making otherwise intolerable situations, in Evie's case, her marriage to this guy, bearable. Now, 2 years ago, I hadn't read a word of Malm. He's fallen very much out of fashion. I'll say a bit more about this as I go along. He's one of those people who got mentioned a lot by people of my parents' generation and who, partly for that reason, were written off. A bit like Nick with his epiphany about radio and the wasteland, I got interested in Malm through a student, in this case an MA student, who wanted to write about him. She was South African, and a curious fact is that Malm's reputation lasted longer in former colonies of Britain, as well as in the USA, than in the UK itself. Meanwhile, she said she wanted to work on this, and I had often thought about something that George Orwell wrote. You'll come to this later in the module, in his 1940 essay Inside the Whale, and where he's talking about the shift from modernist experimentalism in the 1920s in literature, 10s and 20s, to the socially engaged, committed writing of the 1930s. And he's arguing that, on the whole, the first war better than the second from his perspective then. He says the first test of, this is Orwell, the first, and the quotation is on your handout, the first test of any work of art is survival. And it is a fact that a great deal that was written in the period 1910 to 30 has survived and looks like continuing to survive. One has only to think of Ulysses, Joyce's Ulysses, of Human Bondage, most of Lawrence's, D.H. Lawrence's, early work, especially his short stories, and virtually the whole of Eliot's poems up to 1930, to wonder what is being written now, that is around 1940, that will wear so well. So he's picking out Joyce, Malm, Lawrence, and Eliot, putting them together and saying they're more durable from his perspective than people who had come like Auden and MacNeice in the 1930s. Of course, one answer to Orwell's question, who is writing now, who's going to last as well, is Orwell himself. But what I want to think about a bit here for a moment is two things. First, the linkage that Orwell makes between Malm and some of those other writers on his list. Second, the claim that survival is a critical criterion, along with the questions that raises, what makes things survive or not. Now, between 1913 and 1915, 16, depends on whether you're talking about magazine publication or book publication, anyway, in that pretty tight time span, three part autobiographical novels written in English were published in London, which would eventually be translated all over the world. In each of them, and I'll come to a definition of this type of novel in a moment, a clever, emotionally turbulent boy grows up, struggles with his family background and his sexuality, is attracted by the idea of being an artist, and sets out into adult life. The writers had very different kinds of reception, but by the 1920s, they were all very famous. They were Lawrence and Maugham and Joyce. And the novels I'm referring to, which sooner or later attracted so much attention, were Sons and Lovers by Lawrence, Maugham's Human Bondage, and A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, which you're going to come on to next. Now, Maugham was the eldest of those three writers. He was born in 1874, and he had already made a substantial name as a writer when this book that is you've been reading appeared. He'd written a novel called Liza of Lambeth, Zola-esque in its social realism, based on his experiences in East London as a medical student, going into houses of poor people. And that novel had come out in 1897 and had made quite a name. He'd also started writing for the theatre and had an instant success. In 1907, he had four plays running simultaneously in the West End in different theatres. That was a record then, and it was a record that lasted for really quite some time. Another difference between him and the other two writers is that although they were all interested in the life of a modern artist, he really knew it at first hand. He'd lived in Paris between 1903 and 1906. He'd become friends with a young painter called Gerald Kelly, good painter, who was in turn friendly with Rodin and Monet and Degas, the painter that the English often call Degas, but he's not, he's Degas, and Cézanne. And through Kelly, Maugham got to know them. So when Philip Carey rejects art for medicine, he is making a decision which not only has symbolic value, like opting for marriage rather than travel, but reflects in part experiences of Maugham's which were different from those of Joyce's and Lawrence's, and also a decision which separates him from Lawrence's character, Paul Morel, in Sons and Lovers, and Joyce's Stephen Dedalus. Now, there are plenty of other differences between these writers. Maugham, biographically speaking, Maugham took part in the First World War. He went as a hospital orderly because he'd had a medical training in 1914, and he evidently acted with considerable courage and saved people's lives in that role. Later, he became a quite powerful person in the intelligence world, and towards the end of the war, he took part in various espionage activities and undercover diplomatic activities, which he wrote about in an innovative, disillusioned set of spy stories called Ashendom. Those stories, not much read again now, but in print, influenced Ian Fleming and ultimately John le Carré in the way in which they wrote about that world and the connections between it and the deceptions it involved and people's private lives. In the introduction to it, he wrote with dry accuracy, "In 1917, I went to Russia. I was sent to prevent the Bolshevik Revolution and to keep Russia in the war. The reader will know that my efforts did not meet with success." Now, Maugham also was the only one of the three writers who lived to be an old man. And while the others saw their work steadily gaining in reputation, particularly in the literary and intellectual world, Maugham, by contrast, was an instant celebrity. He was, for a long time, almost certainly the richest writer in the world. A story by him called Rain, an interesting story if you're interested in the dealings of the British with the old empire as it's beginning to end, made him alone, that story made him about $1 million out of film adaptations and TV adaptations and stage adaptations. So he was immensely famous and immensely rich, but his reputation declined, as I've intimated, very rapidly before he died. He saw it disappear. Now, already I'm simplifying quite a lot. First of all, Lawrence's reputation, though far from extinct, has been, I would say, in decline for some three or four decades. I'm just interested to know how many of you have read a novel by D.H. Lawrence? How many of you? Yeah, okay, well, a fair sprinkling, but 40 years ago, 1969, everybody in the room would have. How many of you have read anything by Lawrence? Including novels. So it's not very much difference. I mean, I was including poetry and short stories. All right. Now, although, again, another oversimplification in all this is that although most of the people I know, including people in the non-academic literary world, don't read Morm and haven't read Morm, he's still very much in print. Most of his novels are available, many of them in vintage classics reissues, his short stories, his plays, and so on. A new biography has recently appeared. If you look up under his full name, if you go to Amazon, you'll get, in the UK, 2,000-plus results. If you go to Amazon.com, US, you'll get about 6,000. So that there's a clear division between critical reputation, standing in the intellectual literary world, placing on curricula, and the marketplace. Survival, then, George Orwell's criterion, is not just a matter of what is and isn't highly regarded in the literary world, or what is on or isn't on every other university syllabus or the subject of academic books. If you go to the library, you'll find there are very few books, indeed, on Morm. There is another criterion, which Orwell mentions in Inside the Whale. He says, when one says that a writer is fashionable, one practically always means that he's admired by people under 30. Well, one could say that's true of all fashion, not just writing. Anyway, my aim is to make this audience of people mainly under 30 think that they should admire Morm. We'll see how I get on. First of all, before you got the LMW syllabus, again, the same question as about Lawrence. How many of you had read anything by Morm? One, two, three, four? No, four, five. It's like an auction, you know. If I keep going, I may get some more bids. Now, it's not just that Morm isn't admired at the moment. He's actively disliked and thought to be bad by some people. I won't go into my reasons for having got him onto the curriculum this year, and again, I'll talk about curriculum matters briefly later on. But when I did, one of my colleagues who teaches the module sent me this email. I'll be honest, he said, my heart sank when I saw Of Human Bondage on the syllabus, a book I read 20 years ago and assumed I'd never have to read again. Is there no alternative? Whatever the pedagogically useful parallels between Of Human Bondage and Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, they don't begin to compare in terms of literary interest. In terms of content, Of Human Bondage remains for me a monument to closeted self-pity, its classist misogyny too transparent to be analytically interesting, its narcissistic presumption of interest in the details of Carey's Vandayara, his years of wandering, undermined by the tedium of the very long narrative. And then he ended that bit of the email, brackets, can you tell I don't care for it very much? The argument he put in full is much more complicated and sophisticated than just a case of critical antipathy. It bore on the nature of the curriculum, the complex relations between tradition and modernity, among other things. But at heart, he obviously just doesn't like the book. Now, I half agree with one of the points he makes. I do think that Of Human Bondage is longer than it should be, and that point, I think, is half acknowledged by Morm in his preface, where he says that in writing out his obsessive memories of his past, he wanted the wide liberty of the novel rather than the restrictions of theatre. There's somebody who had been for years and years confining himself to the area where he had most success artistically and commercially, and that was writing plays, all of them, you know, a couple of hours long, three acts, two intervals, and a certain shape. And he wanted something else, and perhaps he wanted it too much and indulged himself too much in taking that opportunity. Beyond that, though, and I'm not going to make a lot of a response that was obviously a response from memory of a book read long before, informally in the context of an email about the curriculum. I did ask if I could quote it, though, so I would say that self-pity, one of the things criticized there, is something that adolescents tend to feel and which tends to figure in Bildungsromanen, which I'll come on to that genre in a moment. For example, in Goethe's Werther, which you'll read if you do the European novel course next year, I think Mom's account of Carey's feelings is vivid and true. Carey is a very, very tiresome character, but he is a character, and he's recognizably a human being of a particular kind, truthfully depicted. Secondly, snobbery and misogyny were among the vices of the time, as they are now, but worse. And again, I find the book truthful about them. But the book itself, while displaying characters who are to different degrees and at different stages snobbish and misogynistic, is not, I will argue a bit more in a moment, itself snobbish or misogynistic. Thirdly, Philip's intellectual and moral development during his years of wandering in Heidelberg and Paris and London is to me at least as interesting as Stephen Dedalus's in Dublin. Now, I'm not going to make this point by knocking Joyce's Portrait, which I think is a wonderful book, but I do want to say something about what actually happens in Of Human Bondage. First thing to register is that an early draft of the novel, written as early as 1898, when Joyce and Lawrence were both still at school, had the title The Artistic Temperament of Philip Carey. The novel, the finished novel, is, as I said, a Bildungsroman. There's a bit about that on the handout. I'm very bad at writing on blackboards, so I'm very bad at writing anyway, so that's why I've given it to you on the handout. It's a novel, a narrative about somebody growing up, basically. And in Europe, the genre goes back to Voltaire and Rousseau, as well as Goethe. It belongs to a subgroup of the genre of the Bildungsroman, known as the Künstlerroman, the novel about the formation of an artist, a Künstler. And other examples of a Künstlerroman from the same period as Mohm's include Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, published in 1912, and Willa Cather's Song of the Lark, published in 1915. But you need to register that it's an odd kind of Künstlerroman because it's not about the formation of an artist, because Philip Carey doesn't end up being an artist. He rejects the world of art and decides to become a doctor. To that extent, he differs from his author, and we need to make a distance between author and subject. It's an autobiographical novel, but not an autobiography. So it was originally called The Artistic Temperament of Philip Carey. The title Mohm eventually chose, though, Of Human Bondage, is taken from Spinoza's Ethics. Again, there's some stuff on the handout. Spinoza lived in the 17th century in Holland. He was a Sephardic Jew of Portuguese origin, and his philosophy was deeply inimical to that of Orthodox Jews and also Roman Catholics of the time, and the book was proscribed, and Spinoza himself was shunned by the officials of both religions. It was a book which hugely influenced the Enlightenment, the rational Enlightenment, as we call it, of the 18th century. Essential to its argument is determinism, the idea that essentially what is going to happen to you is going to happen anyway. There's not all that much latitude that individuals have to influence events. But that the more they understand themselves, this is the important inflection in Spinoza's work, the better they understand themselves, the more freedom they have. Not necessarily freedom to escape from their surroundings, their culture, their economic circumstances, but freedom inside to rise above those circumstances. Now, these ideas, of course, are very modern, in inverted commas, although they're 350 years old. They lie behind the development of psychology and psychoanalysis in the early 20th century. Understanding yourself is what all that is about, a cure through understanding yourself. They also lie very clearly that the idea that of the mixture of determinism and a kind of internal freedom that you can develop behind existentialism, a key movement, particularly in French thinking, further back in German thinking, in the mid-20th century. The key passages as far as Mohm is concerned in the Ethics are in Book 4, which is the one he drew on, which is called, as you see from a clip there, Of Human Bondage or the Strength of the Emotions. And the argument, one of the key points made here, is that emotion cannot be governed by reason. You can't say to yourself, it's quite unreasonable for me to feel this about X, X being a person or a situation, therefore I will not feel it. It doesn't work like that. The only thing that can overcome a feeling, Spinoza says in Proposition 7 of Book 4, is a stronger feeling. Now, Philip Carey reads Spinoza among a number of deterministic thinkers in the course of his self-education in the book. He reads Hobbes and Darwin. And the reading of Spinoza comes at a crucial time in the book. It comes after he's decided that he's not really going to make it as an artist. He's not going to persist in that. He doesn't have the obsession. And he's left Paris, and he's living briefly at home with his uncle. And he decides that he's going to train as a doctor. He's had various false starts in his career, but now this is the one he's going to go for. As you know from having read the book, he finds that he gets on well with his patients. His direct experiences of poverty and need, his own experiences, as well as those vicariously of his patients, kind of descale him of this crust of snobbery and nastiness and misogyny that has grown up in his childhood, a kind of preemptive malice, by which I mean a nastiness which is anticipates that other people are going to be nasty to him and therefore takes the form of being nasty first, getting his retaliation in first, as they say in rugby. His eventual choice of the career isn't the result of any desire to do good in a sentimental sense, but of hard-headed realism about the fact that there isn't any guiding philosophy or set of principles that satisfies him. He has to work out his own truth, and crucially, he says, his relation to the world he lives in with the men, meaning human beings, among whom he lives, and finally, his relation to himself. Now, all through the book, Philip is doing that one way or another. He learns for himself, he talks to people, he reads, he experiences a lot, he changes. Much of this is conducted at a considerable intellectual level. It's a book which has a lot to teach us in terms of what it communicates through Philip from his reading. But it also, of course, is very practical, much of it very unhappy, as well as in the terms of the kinds of experiences it relates all too ordinary, experiences of the life of art and of sex and of being poor. And the three are closely interrelated in the novel. Philip learns as much about art from Fanny Price as from anyone else, about specific painters, specific paintings, but also about how judgments are made, the dangers of inherited valuations, the need to make your own decisions about works of art. These are among the things, I mean, that are useful to us now, I think useful to you as you start off on your degree course, to be aware of, particularly the dangers of inherited valuations. He also learns from her something about the way in which, for the artist, him or herself, art can be an obsession quite unrelated to any objective or outside criterion of value. It's important that, A, other people don't think Fanny's work is any good, but that, B, the book doesn't tell us whether, doesn't give us any handle on the question. You could come away from reading it thinking she was actually very talented but scorned by men in a misogynistic world. You could come away from it thinking, well, no, she's a particular unhappy example of a phenomenon all too common in real life, which is somebody who really has to do something, obsessively has to be an artist, but actually will never be thought to be anything by anybody. And the book doesn't tell us about that. Perhaps it's arguing, among other things, that it can't tell us. Now, this obsessive aspect is, of course, related to the book's attitude to sex and to the unhappy experiences of Philip as he grows up and of people who come into contact with him. By the way, in brackets, the book quite often uses the expression make love, and it's quite important that you should know, if you haven't figured out already, that in this period that does not mean having sex. To make love in that period meant something more intense than flirting, but possibly nothing at all physical, and if physical, then of the most tentative kind possible. To make love is to sort of somehow express that, you would like to make love in our sense, but that's a very, very long way down the road. So when they make love in this novel, don't assume that's what that they're doing is in your sense. Now, sex in the novel, as you've seen, is, like art, a matter of suicidal obsession quite often, but not always. Fanny is in love with Philip, who cares for her in some ways, but not enough. And it's after her suicide that the next important relationship in the novel begins, which is his obsession, his tortured fascination with and addiction to Mildred, the waitress, who later on becomes a prostitute. It's relevant that that affair starts with her trivial humiliation of Philip. You have to remember that he's lame, that he's very uncertain of his sexuality and of everything, really. And that when he starts to tease her about another customer who she spends a lot of time with, Miller, who later she marries for a bit, unhappily, when he teases her about it, she says, "I'm here to take orders and wait on customers. I've got nothing to say to them, and I don't want them to say anything to me." And it's that moment that makes him think, "I've got to somehow deal with this." She becomes an obsession to him. And as in Spinoza's view of how the feelings work, he can only get rid of this obsession by replacing it with a stronger emotion. He could not get her out of his mind, the novel says. He laughed angrily at his own foolishness. It was absurd to care what an anemic little waitress said to him, but he was strangely humiliated. Though no one knew of the humiliation but Dunsford, his friend, and he had certainly forgotten, Philip felt he would have no peace till he had wiped it out. And the mechanism he most obviously turns to in the attempt to wipe it out, I think unconsciously turns to, is a mix of snobbery and misogynism. He thinks of Mildred as a slut. He describes her home as common. He notices every behavioral tick in her that he associates with people socially inferior to himself. The questions are, to me, are how far these attitudes are endemic to Philip, how far they are his right the way through the book, and how far he grows out of them, and also how far they infect the whole book, and how far, on the other hand, the book holds them up for scrutiny and leaves us to make up our own minds. Now, you'll probably discuss some of this in seminar, I imagine, and I don't want to spend too long on it. Again, we haven't got very long. But I think that what's happened in judging Morm's writing as misogynistic is that some readers have been infected by what they know of him personally. He was, personally speaking, in his life, exceedingly mixed up about women, to say the least. He was bisexual and eventually entirely homosexual, and he was ill-behaved, I mean, not in a trivial sense, but a truly unpleasant piece of work in a lot of his relationships. But one has, it seems to me, to separate that from his fiction, because among other things, fiction can be, at the most elementary psychological level, a way in which people can present a version of themselves as they would like to be, rather than as they actually are. And if you think about how Of Human Bondage proceeds, the early parts are kind of lightly satirical about a household, Philip's uncle's household, which revolves around the complacent, lazy man, at the expense of the poor aunt who is besotted with her husband and eats less than he does because they haven't got much money, and is very sympathetic to her. Similarly, as I've intimated, while Fanny Price is extremely badly treated by most of the men around her, there is no danger, I think, of our supposing that this is a good way to treat her, that she deserves it in some way. On the contrary, I would argue. And other women in the book, especially Nora Nesbitt, the woman with whom Philip has a really decent affair, but who he can't fall in love with, unhappily, and Mrs. Athelnye and her daughter Sally, are quite neutrally and vividly depicted as well as, I think, helping Philip to grow out of his misogyny and into what I would argue promises to be a more mature emotional life. In other words, the novel diagnoses his misogyny as a temporary state, as a reactive one, and it very painfully shows the circularity of romantic and sexual humiliation, masochism and petty reactions to both of those things, which in turn lead to further humiliation and so on. And while the diagnosis doesn't make pleasant reading, what it reveals is important, and in its circumstantial inevitability, tragic. It also represents, at a sexual level, an engagement on Morm's part with one of the most important social and political phenomena of the time, the women's movement. Now, I've given you some dates on the handout. The period when Morm was gestating and writing the novel was the period when British women were first mobilizing as a group with a political agenda. The National Society for Women's Suffrage, suffrage means voting, of course, was founded in 1872, a couple of years before Morm was born. In 1894, the Local Government Act gave votes in local elections to women who owned property. In 1897, Millicent Fawcett founded the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies, and in 1903, the Women's Social and Political Union was formed in Manchester by a group including Emmeline and Christabel Pankhurst. The following years, as I'm sure you all know, were ones of big, sometimes violent demonstrations by women, of hunger strikes and prison sentences. Women invaded the all-male Houses of Parliament and shouted their demand for the vote from the public galleries. In June 1913, Emily Davison, wanting to attract attention to the suffrage movement, went to the Derby races and threw herself under a racehorse owned by the king and died of her injuries. This was the very time in which Morm's novel was being finished and published. And these activities, which were going on in different versions in many parts of the world, have to be taken as a synecdoche for all aspects of women's struggle to be treated on equal terms with men. Now, of course, I'm not suggesting that Morm's novel says, give women the vote. But I would argue that it does present women in a light that would lend support to that proposition. More specifically, and arguably more importantly, it depicts women both as victims of broad and deep material and social inequalities, and also as free agents in respect of their own sexual behavior, especially in the cases of Nora and Sally. This was an issue which always absorbed Morm, and which he developed further in a novel called Cakes and Ale, 1930. So, to the question, why did Morm's work fall out of fashion? At least part of the reason, I believe, was the force of the propaganda put out by the British modernists, particularly as far as the English novel was concerned, by members of the Bloomsbury Group. Virginia Woolf, one of the key members of the Bloomsbury Group, was an exact contemporary of James Joyce, who you're coming on to next. They had very different backgrounds and educations, but they were both of them influenced by current developments in psychology, particularly Freud's writings on the unconscious, which were first being published in the first years of the 20th century. They were also influenced by the arts, particularly Impressionism and Post-Impressionism. There was a big exhibition called Manet and the Post-Impressionists in London in 1910, which was organized by another member of the Bloomsbury Group, Roger Fry. Now, in both cases, and what I'm saying here is kind of by way of introduction to the novel in the modern world, generally speaking. In both cases, psychology and the visual arts, the concern was, very simply put, to dig beneath surface appearances and to identify and record the experiences of the subjective self. In literature, what this came to mean, again, very crudely speaking, was to try to produce a kind of verbal version of a brain scan, as distinct from the writer's, concerning him or herself with details of the external world arranged interesting narrative ways and with exciting action. Above all, anything that seemed to prioritize narrative and plot above individual psychology was treated as obsolete. My point is not that the writer's views were wrong at all. My point is that In developing any new artistic or intellectual movement, people exaggerate. They push their own case, and in doing so, to persuade people, they rubbish other kinds of work. I don't think readers, discriminating readers, read like that. They're able to appreciate different kinds of work. Now, Virginia Woolf developed her ideas along these lines in a number of essays published between 1919 and 1925. The most famous is Mr. Bennett and Mr. Brown, which was published in 1919, and it was an attack on the social realist novelist Arnold Bennett, whom Morm knew and spent time with in Paris. But even more, it was an attack on people who were interested in telling a compelling story and putting it in a broad and externally described context. But even more influential on the next generation of educated readers was a little book called Aspects of the Novel by E.M. Forster, which began as a series of lectures given in a prestigious series, the Clark Lectures, at Cambridge in 1927. I'll say something about that context, Cambridge in 1927, in a moment. The most quoted words in the book come at the end of the introduction to Lecture 2, which is on the story, and it's on page 2 of the handout at the top. Let us listen to three voices. If you ask one type of man, what does a novel do? He will reply placidly, well, I don't know. It seems a funny sort of question to ask. A novel's a novel. Well, I don't know, I suppose it kind of tells a story, so to speak. He is quite good-tempered and vague, and probably driving a motor bus at the same time, and paying no more attention to literature than it merits. Another man, whom I visualize as on a golf course, will be aggressive and brisk. He will reply, what does a novel do? Why, tell a story, of course, and I've no use for it if it didn't. I like a story. Very bad taste on my part, no doubt, but I like a story. You can take your art, you can take your literature, you can take your music, but give me a good story. And I like a story to be a story, mind, and my wife's the same. It's a bit like the Colonel in Morm's story that I was talking about earlier. And the third man, he says, in a sort of drooping, regretful voice, yes, oh dear, yes, the novel tells a story. I respect and admire the first speaker, Forster says to me rather unconvincingly, I detest and fear the second, I'm sure that was true, and the third is myself. Yes, oh dear, yes, the novel tells a story. That is the fundamental aspect without which it could not exist. That is the highest factor common to all novels, and I wish it was not common, and I wish it was not so that it could be something different, melody or perception of the truth, not this low, atavistic form. Now, when Forster said that, he was already a famous novelist. He, most recently, the author of A Passage to India, 1924, as well as a respected critic. But the importance of aspects of a novel in terms of literary history lies also in its institutional authority. The English faculty at Cambridge was new. It had been founded in 1919. A very few other places had allowed English to be studied before that date, Edinburgh and UCL in the 19th century, Oxford in 1914, but they treated it as a language to be studied as an adjunct to, as the main thing, and the literature as an adjunct to it. And because the analogy was with ancient literature and classics, the older the literature, the better, and the more difficult to understand, the better, and you had to learn the language before you read it. I don't know whether it's still true, but when I was at Oxford, Course 1, as it was called, ended just before Shakespeare. And I'm not quite as old as that might suggest. Now, Cambridge was the first English faculty to bring the subject up to what was then the present day, and to treat literature in its own right. So Forster was not only delivering a fashionable point of view, which he had imbibed through his contacts with Bloomsbury, as well as with the sources that were influential on Bloomsbury people, but he was doing so in a place which combined institutional power with what was in its day a cutting-edge approach to literature. Now, like everything he wrote, his argument in Aspects of the Novel is light in tone, it's whimsical, a little ironic. There's none of the dogmatic urgency we associate on the one hand with some of the more forceful modernist pioneers like Pound, or on the other with subsequent Cambridge critics like F.R. Leavis. So perhaps we shouldn't take too seriously the precise way in which he categorizes and satirizes responses to his question, what does a novel do? Still, to suggest, even if only semi-seriously, that the views of a hypothetical bus driver and of a hypothetical person on a golf course are not to be taken as seriously as those of someone who is not only a novelist, but for the moment at least a lecturer at Cambridge University, clearly implies two things, doesn't it? One is that ordinary people are bad judges of literature, and the other is that the best judges are writers themselves, perhaps especially when they're standing in a lecture theatre. Now, I've already said that in your reading here at Warwick, you should be thinking not only about the set books, but about the processes by which they become that. In matters of artistic judgment, there are never right and wrong answers. This is one of Morm's points in Of Human Bondage, and it's one of the things that makes our subject so interesting to pursue. It's also one of the reasons that that arguments in the subject are so intense. Arguments are always more intense when you can't prove the answer than when you can. Nobody is going to get terribly upset if you say 2 and 2 are 5, because they just know you're wrong. Power is involved here. Access to audiences, especially through the media, power of persuasion, especially through rhetorical devices like humor, employed by Forster for his audience, social ones like snobbery, even the negligible seeming power of tutors in their decisions about what to put on a curriculum. If the outcome of your seminars is that your tutors end up thinking, really, this was a disaster putting Of Human Bondage on the syllabus, it'll go off. It'll be taken off. So you will have an influence in these matters. All this is relevant to the question I raised through Orwell early on. What does make some books survive? Some books die. And even more interesting to me, what makes some come to life after they've seemed to be dead? If T.S. Eliot had not written his famous essays on the metaphysical poets in the Times Literary Supplement, people would not have been reading Marvell and Donne in the way that they do now. They'd been forgotten as writers, more or less. Actually, I don't think it quite works exactly like that, but Eliot was very, very influential in recovering those writers. I want to end just a couple of minutes, I'll be very quick, by asking the question, in what sense is this a Künstlerroman, a novel about the life of an artist? As I said, Morm is clear in his foreword that while the book is an autobiographical novel, it's not an autobiography. Philip thinks hard about being a painter. He undergoes some training, but he decides he's neither quite good enough nor sufficiently obsessed with that ambition. But he has another vocation, which by the end of the novel he could easily realize if he was ruthless enough, and that's to travel the world. He's qualified as a doctor. He wants to travel. He could go anywhere he wants and work. But he thinks Sally's pregnant, and that makes him realize at first that he should marry her, and then that actually he wants to marry her, so that when he finds that she's not pregnant, it was just a false alarm, he still wants to marry her. And he gives up the idea of traveling, and he settles for marriage to her under ordinary country practice. Now, more in this area, the novel bears no relation whatever to Morm's own life. Morm became a writer. He traveled extremely widely, and particularly in what was then called the Far East and the South Pacific. And I just want to flag one thing up about the result of those travels, which doesn't relate to Of Human Bondage, but may relate to your thinking in the future if you think Morm is an interesting writer. And that is, in his travels, he was a very sharp observer of the behavior of expatriates in colonial countries, colonized countries. He said, I was like a naturalist who comes into a country where the fauna are of an unimaginable variety. They had learnt life in a different school from mine, these sort of imperial people and doctors and missionaries in the colonies. They had their prejudices. They had their narrownesses. I didn't care. They seemed to me nearer to the elementals of human nature than any of the people I'd been living with for so long, and my heart leapt towards them as it had done years before to the people who filed into the outpatient's room at St. Thomas's Hospital. Morm quietly exposes the hypocrisies and the vanities and the follies, as well as some of the decencies of the people he encounters in that world. And he doesn't deal in abstractions. He doesn't say colonization equals evil. But one of the elements of this module is to think about literature's role as a critique of power, of all kinds of power. And I want to register that on that score too, Morm arguably deserves a place in your reading. And if you're interested in pursuing that now or later, you'll see that the last item on the handout refers to Morm and the colonial world and gives you a couple of stories to follow up. So I rest my case.